Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey, Mark, this is a slightly different type of episode. Believe it or not, it began with a lot of investigation, a lot of work that Rebecca and I have been doing on the CBI front, you know, the citizenship by investment, and, you know, just the general marketing. And that is the fact that we've been looking at different markets. And funnily enough, for almost a year, Afghanistan keeps popping up. And recently, I have been talking to a ton of Afghan people who have found their way into Europe, Turkey, and other countries, and are looking to come into either the UK or to the US, and some even Canada. And the one thing I would like to thank all of our listeners for is that over the years, and this is we're going into our seventh year with this podcast series, we have been bringing out issues that we want to bring across. I don't know whether we make a difference, but we try, whether it's through our podcast or through our writing. And there is a very strong story behind today's podcast that I think, Rebecca, we felt very strongly about that we wanted to bring out.
Yes, I know it's completely different from our EB5 topic, but like you said, we came to it because we have been going out into the markets and seeing, you know, like we were traveling to all these countries and seeing a lot more Afghans coming out. And not only that, it's also close to our hearts. Like we said, we've worked in areas like this in the past and we continue and still want to do this. So I think this has been something interesting and dear to us.
Yes. And in case our listeners are thinking, what area are you talking about? We're talking about the area of women's rights.
Yes.
And we are honored today that we have two very renowned political journalists on our show.
We do indeed, Mona. In today's episode, we are featuring a journalism team embedded in Afghanistan to give us a firsthand information on what's happening there. Ramita is an Emmy and Robert F. Kennedy award-winning journalist and author. She is known for traveling to hostile environments and has reported on stories including the war in South Sudan, blood diamonds in Zimbabwe, militias in Iraq, and more. Her book, City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death, and the Search for the Truth in Tehran, was declared a book of the year in both the Evening Standard and The Spectator. Karim is an Emmy Award-winning producer and director. He specializes in investigative documentaries captured around the globe and has worked in nearly 40 countries, including Mali and North Korea. He has worked for PBS, Al Jazeera, ITV Channel 4, and most recently joined the BBC Africa team. Ramita, Karim, welcome to EB5 Investment Voice.
Hi.
Hi, Mark. Nice to meet you.
So gosh, you've just heard myself and Rebecca discuss why we have been looking at Afghanistan lately. But I have to say, Ramita, Karim, your story is amazing. Why? What made you travel to Afghanistan? Was it being the Americans coming out? What was it, Ramita?
Well, I started looking at this story about, six, seven months before the fall of Kabul. So it was the beginning of the year 2021. And I was noticing that the Taliban was taking territory really fast, faster than was being reported, faster than was expected. People were predicting that Kabul would fall much sooner than everyone was saying. And of course, it was even sooner than Western intelligence had guessed. And I was looking at areas, these areas that the Taliban was sweeping through and seeing what was happening there. And it wasn't pretty. And I was specifically looking at how the Taliban were treating women in these areas. I wanted it to kind of serve as a warning for what may happen once the Americans withdraw and once the Taliban took over. But of course, that became reality far sooner than we expected. So we had a real story on our hands.
What were the signs that you saw? I'm so intrigued in all of this, because the interesting thing is, if I look back and when we were preparing for this podcast, I was looking at some notes that I had made We started getting contacted by people from Afghanistan almost 6 months to a year before the fall. So it's almost the same time.
Yeah. So public floggings, women's rights diminishing, women being policed in a way men were not being policed. Basically, the Taliban in the late 1990s. And that was really interesting to chart when they did take over, because when they did take over, they were very savvy and aware the world was watching. And so they were very careful to talk about women's rights and how they would protect women's rights, which is what they did in their very first press conference. So they were trying to say, we're more moderate, we've reformed, we've moved with the times. But of course, what I'd been charting all those months before was that they actually hadn't. So, you know, Karim and I waited for a couple of months after the fall of Kabul. And that was another discussion. When should we go in? Because we need to give them enough time, first of all, to start governing. Because, as you know, at first, it was absolute chaos.
Right.
Secondly, to be comfortable enough to see if they would revert to type. So, you know, there was no point in us going in immediately. We had to wait for the news story to calm down and for normality to kind of resume, and then to go in and examine, is this the Taliban of old, or have they really reformed? Are they protecting women's rights as they keep promising they are doing?
And all of this you saw whilst the Americans were technically in power?
Yeah, so under the previous Afghan government.
I see.
So under the previous Afghan government, so technically the Americans weren't in power, but under Ghani's government, what we were seeing was that they were losing the war. So we know America was losing the war against the Taliban. I mean, they've been losing the war against the Taliban for a long time now.
Yeah.
This is what was so surprising, is the speed at which the Taliban took over. And of course, there was lots of reporting about Afghan troops not fighting hard enough, not being brave enough, not fighting back, not all of which was true. But something I think which is interesting and which is worth noting is that in some of these areas, people had had enough of the corruption of the old government. And they did see the Taliban as kind of firm hand of justice coming in and sweeping out corruption. And you're talking about, you know, really poor rural areas here where your main thoughts are feeding your family.
Can I ask Ramita and Karim, if you want to jump in, where you're seeing, like you said, you're seeing this in the poorer neighborhoods. Is this what you're seeing throughout, even in the wealthier neighborhoods? Are women being treated differently within different sectors? What have you seen within the different, I guess, socioeconomic patterns?
Karim, I've rambled on far too long.
We don't mind. We love hearing your voice.
I mean, there's definitely in different regions in Afghanistan, women are afforded more rights than in other regions, historically even. Going back to what we're talking about, like Taliban control of Afghanistan, in my own experience, and for many journalists, you know, in traveling to the countryside in Afghanistan, outside of Kabul, basically, for many years, those areas have been controlled by the Taliban, and on paper, they've been called contested. But really, when you actually go there, you realize all that means is that there's an Afghan army fire base and they control up to their sandbags, you know. And so there's swathes of territory that was already controlled by the Taliban.
But Karim and Ramita, how do you actually find your examples and your the people that you interviewed? You know, was that just through just going door to door and asking questions?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's from, we've both been doing this a long time and we have very good contacts in country and very good contacts with local journalists. So it's not just people who, you know, Afghans who work with international press, but rather, you know, local journalists on a provincial level. And they were one of our main initial sources.
But Ramita, obviously you being a woman, Karim's a guy, it is easier for him to get around. Are you not stopped when you move around and try and interview women? I mean, it must be far more dangerous for you.
Not really. I'm older and I can speak the language and I cover up. So I blend in. So actually, I don't set off any alarm bells. I think it would be different if I was blonde and white. And I think it helped as well that Karim is half Pakistani. So he also can pass as a local, you know, he wears local clothes. And I think that made it quite easy for us to operate. When we were there, certainly in cities and towns, Kabul, Herat, women are out and about. You just have to be careful to observe the Taliban's rules.
And we didn't just like bowl in and start like, you know, asking people like left, right and center. I mean, firstly, because it's dangerous. It's not just for us, but it's dangerous for them. You know, anyone we spoke to did that at like massive, massive risk. You can't like not stress that enough. And before we went out, we had a good, I mean, we're talking about months of like research from London through our Afghan contacts. And then, you know, that snowballs. Ramita was talking to loads of activists, and then not just activists, you know, from the activists, we're talking to regular women who are, you know, not have nothing to do with journalism. So we spent a long time doing research from here and working out who would speak to and where would go. Obviously, when we're there on the ground, things change and, you know, and new sources come up and stuff. But it wasn't like, you know, we're just going to like rock around Afghanistan and speak to women left, right, and center because of the dangers.
Right. Oh, I have enormous respect for political journalists because I know the dangers that you guys go through. Let me ask you, there must have been some shocking moments in all of this.
Well, how about I saw from the documentary itself, Karim, is that, you know, they did come to you and they were telling you no taping. I mean, maybe tell us a little bit about how you felt at that point. Did you feel...
Mostly I felt a bit stupid because we did know that, like, since the Taliban took power, the kind of consensus among, like, most of our colleagues is that in many ways, Afghanistan's a kind of safer place to work. But it's kind of safer if you're a Western journalist, as in there's no fighting, you can travel around relatively freely, you can drive around the country, which you couldn't really do before. But there are definitely red lines. And one of those red lines is filming anything about female protests. So we knew that filming those protests would be a risk. And I know personally Afghan journalists who have been caught filming those protests and have been really badly beaten up by the Taliban.
Oh, gosh.
The initial idea was that, you know, I'd stay well away from the protests. And I thought I was at a distance. But and in Kabul as well, you know, after a few days at the Taliban in Kabul, a lot of them are wearing like official uniforms and stuff. So you think, okay, you can spot them. But the lesson we learned there was like, I mean, there's Taliban all over the place. And before they accosted me and took the camera, they assumed I was an Afghan and they were shouting at me, saying like all these horrible things they're going to do to me and all this kind of stuff. And then when they did come and approach me and realized I was the foreigner, then they just took the camera and just told us to follow them. But we left the area as quickly as we could.
Well, that actually was one of my questions to both you, Karim, and Ramita. Does it make a difference? I mean, you're both British. Does it make a difference whether you're from Britain, Europe or America, for example? Do they treat you differently, say, for example, a reporter coming in from India?
I think when you get caught, I mean, if you got detained by the Taliban, you're more likely to be released or you're nothing bad happened to you. But yeah, I mean, Afghan journalists have been, I mean, really badly punished in detention. I mean, there are many Afghan journalists that have went missing since the Taliban have come into power. So yeah, it's a massive difference.
Ramita, did you see the same type of behavior amongst women from, say, high net worth backgrounds as you do in the poorer areas? Is there a marked distinction?
What do you mean? What do you mean by type of behavior?
Like abuse towards women. Is it across the board or is it more prevalent in the poorer neighborhoods?
So you mean not perpetrated by the Taliban, but kind of sociocultural?
A bit of
attitudes.
Both, actually. That was my next question, yeah. Whether it was sociocultural or Taliban.
I would say that the big distinction is urban-rural. So it's much harder for rural women living in rural areas than it is for women in the cities. And that's obviously education, development, cities. It's much easier to be anonymous. There's kind of nowhere to flee if you're in a small village in a faraway province. Whereas in Kabul, you can move from safe house to safe house. So I would say in terms of Taliban enforcement, it's far harder to enforce across evenly across the female population in a big, packed, overpopulated city than it is in the provinces. Socioculturally, I mean, Afghanistan is a very patriarchal society. There is an argument that is regularly made to say that actually for many women in Afghanistan, life hasn't changed that much since the Taliban took over. And to a degree, I would say that is true. What has changed is that there was development and there was reform. Even if it wasn't for every single woman, that has a trickle-down effect. And that has a psychological effect as well. Women now in rural areas where life is pretty much the same, they have lost those beacons of hope and they have lost those examples that they can now look to. So the situation is hopeless for all women.
Wow, that's a very sober thought. Can I ask you why? What message do either of you want to bring out from putting across this documentary? Or what message would you like the Western world to take from there?
I want Western governments and the United Nations to use our documentary as evidence of what the Taliban is really doing and how they are really treating half the population of the country. And they can use this evidence to negotiate with the Taliban. Right now, the Taliban still needs the West, needs the United Nations more than they need the Taliban. So right now, the Taliban still wants international recognition and is trying to keep the West on board. So they are in a position to negotiate. And I think that's really important.
Many of the women who feature in the film have left Afghanistan now. But I know of one young woman who is trying to get to the United States. She's out of Afghanistan and she's applying for humanitarian parole. We spent a long time verifying her story. She's in real danger in Afghanistan. And this is someone with no baggage, she's not bringing 20 relatives with her. And she's had a humanitarian parole denied by the US. And I just find it unbelievable that there's so many people in Afghanistan who are in danger and they're not given sanctuary in European or other Western countries. I think that's terrible. So I hope the film does change public opinion and makes people understand that, these things happening in Afghanistan are real.
Yeah. I do hope so myself, and I hope there's some leeway there because, as I said earlier, that we are being contacted and we have spoken. I personally have spoken to a whole group of people who have left Afghanistan in the last year and settled themselves in countries like Turkey and around, but they don't want to live there. They do want to keep on finding a real home. And I do hope that, because with any of our petitions, with anything to do with business immigration, we do have to source funds, and sourcing funds is not easy from the situation that we have. Rebecca, I don't even know how we would even tackle some of the source of funds that I'm hearing.
I know. Yeah.
It brings up to me, how seriously do we really take women's rights? Because, you hear about people being deported back to Afghanistan now.
Yeah.
And it wasn't happening before because there was fighting, But now it's fine, and I think it's a bit of a test really for us, do we really believe this? And is that really one of the reasons why, that we stayed there so long and tried to do what we did there and invest all the money we did there?
But Krim, I do. I find that surprising that, even the US, like you said, denying her humanitarian parole coming into the country, it's just, I'm shocked that we wouldn't provide any more help. But Mona, like you said, we're seeing more and more coming out, but through the investment opportunities. And then it's how many can actually come out through that route?
Oh, we're talking a handful. And from what I hear from Ramita and Karim, there's a lot of women over there who don't even have an opportunity. Forget high net worth individuals. Mm-hmm. They don't even seem to be having an opportunity on an asylum front. Ramita, would you go back, even though now your name and everything is out there? Would you go back into the country and say, produce another documentary?
I would love to go back, but I doubt I'll get a visa. So I don't know how I would get in unless I was smuggled in. So I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. But I would give anything to go back and to go back with Kareem, my partner in this, and to carry on, because that's, I think that's really important as well. You know, people lose interest.
That's exactly what I was about to say. So I've noticed personally that there's an apathy now. People just, after, initially everybody was interested and the CNN would play it back to back, etc. And same with the BBC. But now there's an apathy. People aren't interested anymore. They're bored. They move on.
Yeah, Ukraine happened, took attention away. And also people feel that they know a story that, oh, women in Afghanistan, yeah, it's really bad. So I think, you know, it's our job to constantly have to come up with an angle to make people sit up and listen and to be dogged about it and to continue trying to tell stories, even if the news agenda has moved on. And it's to make sure that these humans, these people are not forgotten.
Well, being one of, I seem like I'm the only American on the podcast today, but it's just that America is so far away from all that's happening. And I feel like there's just a lot of ignorance that goes on around as well. So unfortunately, you know, you're seeing it on the news, but it is, they kind of see it and then they move on.
It's too far removed. It's too far removed. You know, I hear you. I think if you can get a voice out and you can make some noise that United Nations and Western countries take notice.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the areas. I mean, Mona, you and I, we did asylum cases in the past. We've done violence to help women. I mean, it is a passion of ours. And I applaud you both, Karim and Ramita, for going out there and putting this in and getting the information out to everyone.
Right. We, in the past, we've even set up foundations for women in overseas countries like here. This, do you see any change on the horizon, Karim?
Change in our relationship to Afghanistan?
Well, in the relationship of women, do you think that it could happen, or has it become so firmly entrenched in your opinion that it's going to take a huge, maybe a hurricane or something to move it?
I mean, basically the Taliban's line is like, we've just got some like teething problems. We've got, like, if we take like girls' schools, for example, it's been almost a year now where girls haven't been able to go to secondary school. You know, the same excuse has been, oh, well, we'll have to work out how do they get to school properly and segregation. I mean, schools are segregated anyway. So they're coming out with these excuses as to why they can't afford people equal rights. And I think if they were going to do something, they would have done it by now. I think it can only get worse, really.
Is that your opinion too, Ramita?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, any change that's happened since the Taliban has been in power has been for the worse. So I think it's a story we just have to follow. And I think it's a volatile country. Who knows what will happen? Mm-hmm. Countries like Afghanistan, in my experience, are quite hard to predict. So,
and any social change in any country predominantly comes from women. You know, unless you're like, women are afforded education, and how can they educate their children? You know, so it's like, it's pretty smart on the Taliban in some ways. You know, if you want to really like, you know, pull the carpet away, just don't let women, deny women education, deny women their rights, deny women their place in the workplace. And then that's such a frustrating thing about Afghanistan now, is like, you know, we've never seen it this bad there in terms of like poverty, kids begging on the streets. I mean, I've never seen it that bad. You know, it's a crisis, and it should be all hands on deck. We met so many brilliant people, women, who the country desperately needs them back at work, just so the place can stay afloat. But the Taliban, it's like they're shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, Karim, that leads me to another question. You have a tremendous experience now as a political journalist. What led you to Afghanistan?
Well, in general or in this film?
In this film, specifically. Was it your association with Ramita?
Did you
bully him to coming along with you?
Well, Kareem has an amazing reputation. Actually, did you find out you'd won the Emmy just before or after you agreed to work with me?
Maybe before, yeah.
Right, sounds so humble.
Yeah. Well, I'll big him up because I wanted to do this story and I needed a director. People kept saying one name, and that was Kareem Shah. And of course, I knew of him. We both worked for the same program, but at different times. And we have lots of friends and colleagues in common. But I'd never worked with him. And, you know, this is a big, ambitious project. So I had to be really sure. But three people I absolutely trust and respect, whose judgment is spot on. All three of them said Karim. So I had one chat to him. I knew not only does he know what he's talking about, he understands Afghanistan. He knows Afghanistan. That was the main thing. Because, of course, like I said, he's award-winning journalist who's made a film from Afghanistan. He's been to Afghanistan, you know, several times. So he knows it really well. He knows how to operate there, was number one. Number two, you know, this is was important as well, that it wasn't, you know, some tall, blonde, white dude who would just stick out like a sore thumb and put us both in danger. He was somebody who could blend in. And as important, number three, that he was a really nice guy. I'm reached an age where I'm just too old to work with people who are difficult, who are divas, who have egos. And yeah, I mean, he's got a reputation for being a really great, good guy. And yeah, well, I mean, I just got lucky. And on top of all of that, he's also very funny. So apart from being a bit moody in the morning.
Well, I have to say, Ramita, you did an amazing job also. You need a team. In any of these things, it's a team which works. And I think Karim is going to say he wouldn't have been able to complete this documentary without you either. Right, Karim?
I mean,
oh, God, don't actually worry. Don't blow smoke up my ass now.
I remember when you called Ramita, I was like walking around the park. And my initial thoughts were like, how are you going to make this film? Because how are you going to get anyone to go on camera safely?
You were in two minds, weren't you?
Yeah,
you had to
think about it. Totally. And then also, you know, in terms of like things that surprised us on the ground in Afghanistan, I think it was like the attitude of women in rural areas and in the provinces, as in like, I was pretty much in the camp of, well, you know, it's always been like that. The Taliban are there. And even if they're not there, like, you know, the countryside is like, it's really draconian and like patriarchal. So there's not much difference now that the Taliban being in power. But actually, what did surprise me is we had a few interviews of women from the provinces, and they were like, no, I mean, not just like idea of hope. I mean, remember in the north in Badakhshan, that when we, I mean, it didn't make the cut, unfortunately, but a woman who lived in like a rural area, like family worked the land, and she described a totally different, freer way of life pre-Taliban, and even described the moment when the Taliban pretty much came to her village and rounded everyone up and said, right, these are the rules now. And they were different, you know, and this woman had to change her whole way of life.
Yeah, I know, you're right. And actually, it's worth pointing out, isn't it? Remember the kind of mini conference we went to, it was a little ceremony,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
So we went to this ceremony for students of this speech writing course. And we were completely blown away by scores of young women. So women kind of late teens, early 20s, wearing high heels, loads of makeup, and kind of sexy hijabs. And I couldn't believe it. And I sidled up to one of them in shock saying, isn't it dangerous? And it was their form of rebellion. They felt that there was safety in numbers, and it was their one-fingered salute to the Taliban. And that was kind of, yeah, youth rebellion for you.
This podcast series has been running almost 7 years, and we've often picked up a topic just because we want to get the information out to all our listeners, etc. Here's one message. As you've given your message, Ramita. You would like Western governments, United Nations, and people to make a difference. But here's my two cents on this. You have to be consistent, and you have to continually be banging the door. If you're not continually banging the door, little rebellions, they're a good news story, but it's not going to make any difference.
Yeah, but I guess that's also how a society does change over time. And you see that in Iran. You know, you see what the youth has done in Iran, that you have this massive youth population, as you do in Afghanistan. It's increasingly hard to control, you know, and psychologically as well. That's psychological, that's important for survival, to feel that you have got some kind of autonomy over your life.
Well, we really wish you both the best. Karim, I understand you're now working for the BBC, but you're in the African department. Any plans on doing a similar kind of documentary out there in Africa? Because there's a lot happening to women over there too.
Yeah, unfortunately,
stories about like gender inequality and oppression of women are just like, they're in every continent, you know, so mm-hmm. they're not going away.
But any plans to do a similar type of documentary from Africa?
I mean, actually, in my unit, you know, there's lots of investigations going on and they're from African journalists and I'm just there to kind of like, kind of help them. But I can't talk about ongoing investigations.
We understand. I can tell you, though, that that I don't know if it helps or not, that we're having a lot of interest in all of the CBI programs, which is Citizenship by Investment, as well as straight immigration from many of the African countries. Nigeria is one of the hottest new country, for example. And you still have Kenya and of course, South Africa. So where there's a lot of immigration coming from. So it is interesting. And we also been contacted by a lot of very professional women from Nigeria, women who mm-hmm. are at the top of their professions, doctors, lawyers, and others. And
I've made a couple of films in Nigeria and I've got a lot of colleagues there. And I'm just amazed at Nigerian people because like the state seems so absent and that things can, I mean, there's so many issues and that things can keep ticking along. It's just like amazing. And it's testament to like to really like innovative people.
You know, Rumita Kurim, if you had a message for anyone in government, say the US government now who's listening to this, whether they're on the Hill or, you know, whether we have it elsewhere, what would you say to them?
I would say that be aware that the Taliban are very sensitive about the issue of women. It's a story they don't want out, which means that there's leverage. You can use this as leverage. Please use this to negotiate with them. We urge you to use this to negotiate with them. I would also say that we all know about the cases of judges and lawyers living in fear and in hiding in Afghanistan. There are four lawyers we know of that we interviewed who are all in hiding and are all absolutely terrified. Two of them were prosecuting people on terrorism charges. So, of course, these are Talibs. And they need to get out of the country. And there are many Afghans who have been trained by America, trained by the West, who are still in fear of their lives in Afghanistan, who haven't been able to get out the country. So I would say as well, you know, there are thousands of Afghans on evacuation lists. And those evacuation lists are just going nowhere. They've completely come to a halt. Please look at those lists. Please get in touch with us, because there are many individual cases that we can vouch for, people that you can actively help who need to get out the country, who would be an absolute asset to any Western country.
That's very powerful, Rumita. Thank you.
Yes, Rumita, Kurim, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice. But before we let you go, where can people find this documentary so they can watch it for themselves?
It's on the PBS Frontline website.
Thank you for that. And to make it easy for our podcast listeners, we will go ahead and put a direct link to that documentary both in the podcast player and the show notes so you can watch it from your computer or your phone. Again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.